We like to start our class by going down into our heart space, Chris.
Okay, heart space.
Heart space, and the way we do that is by making the sound of Om together.
Okay.
We'll make the sound of Om together. So we'll begin by taking three conscious breaths together. And with a deep in-breath, Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. We're going to study the wisdom of Sat Chit Ananda. Sat Chit Ananda. Sat Chit Ananda is from India, of course, and he lived in this country for many years. He established an ashram, or a place of worship and study, here in Virginia. It's down south of Charlottesville, and it's called Yogaville. Yogaville. It's a beautiful place. Many people in our congregation have been there many times. It has a beautiful meditation temple. And they teach different sorts of classes. They not only teach hatha yoga classes, postures, but they also teach breathing practices, pranayama, and they teach what we will learn here today, which is the deeper science and wisdom of yoga.
Yoga.
He will use the Bhagavad Gita as a scriptural text. The purpose is for us to find a path for personal spiritual transformation. On our quest for a path for personal spiritual transformation through the study of the Bhagavad Gita, which interpreted is the song of the Lord, or the song of God. The song of the Lord. We're going to study Karma Yoga today, Chapter 3, Bhagavad Gita. We heard something about karma today in the service, didn't we?
We did, yes.
We did. Karma. Reverend Russ said it's the law of cause and effect. A more ancient meaning of karma is action. Karma is action. The yoga of action. So today we're going to study things we do, actions we take. We've been studying this for a while. We're going to jump right in Chapter 3, Karma Yoga, to verse number 10. Or these verses are called slokas in Sanskrit. I encourage you, by the way, if you have questions, to speak up, or if you have observations from your own personal experience, to share them with the group. We'd like to hear whatever is true for you.
Yeah.
That really helps us understand what Sat Chit Ananda said.
Yes.
Here we go, verse number 10. After creating humankind together with yajna, or sacrifice, the Creator said, through sacrifice you will increase yourself and get everything you want. The scripture. Yes?
I like that a lot. I sacrifice inside a little bit. Nothing compared to people, but I do my best.
We're going to talk about sacrifice today, what it means. This sacrifice, of course, is not a blood sacrifice, isn't it? The Sanskrit word is yajna. Rather, it's a personal sacrifice, a giving up. Mm-hmm. Perhaps a giving up of our selfish ego consciousness. A giving up, a letting go for a higher purpose. So here we hear that we were created, men were created, women were created, together with sacrifice. We were created, and at the same time, sacrifice was created. And the Creator said, when the Creator said in the Bible, in the beginning there was light, here's a different interpretation. Through sacrifice, you will increase yourself, expand yourself into your true self, and get everything you want. Last week, we talked about what it is we want, and we learned some dangers or risks involved in what we want. Mm-hmm. What we want. Sometimes we want something very badly, and the tragedy is we get it.
Yes.
We get it. So what we, or it may not be a tragedy, it may be part of our karma. That is to say, actions follow actions. So when we want something, it's a set of expectations. Sometimes when we have expectations, expect things to turn out a certain way, and they don't, we get upset. We get upset when things don't turn out the way we expect. We don't get what we desire or what we want. We talked about that last week.
Others would say peace is similar to wish or desire or want. Sometimes.
The scriptures say that, and this is from the Bible, what does the Bible say? When Jesus was asked, what is the greatest commandment, the greatest thing you should want, he said, according to the Bible, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, all thy soul, all your mind, all your strength. He went on to say, you shall also love your neighbor as yourself. But the first part, you shall love God. In other words, you shall want to be in a state where all you see is what's divine. When you look at other people, experience the divine.
Because sharing love is sharing what you experience love to be.
Yes, sharing love. Wanting or desiring to be continually or more in that state of love and openness.
Right. It's to be open. Right?
Open, right. And not attached to our reactive minds. Not attached to our reactive minds. We all have reactive minds. It's part of our human nature. Our spiritual quest is to notice we have reactive minds, built-in wants, desires. It's part of our evolutionary nature, part of our instinct to survive, to eat, to sleep, to procreate. And our spiritual nature is to try to notice more those aspects of ourselves and have those aspects show up in a way that is beneficial to everyone so that we can make our life a sacrifice. Today we'll talk more about what it means to make your life a sacrifice. Okay. Here's Swami Satchidananda's commentary. Do you know what the word Swami means, by the way?
Teacher, yeah.
Master.
Actually, it means renunciate. Renunciate. A swami is a renunciate.
Aha. It makes sense to say teacher a little bit, then, yeah, at least.
So
yeah.
What is Sri?
Sri is like sir or mister or monsieur, senor.
Respect, but like
it's an honorific.
Okay.
The root of Sri is majestic. Majestic. So when we say Mr. or Mrs., we're honoring and respecting someone. Sri goes a bit farther. It's seeing the majesty. As when in the Indian tradition one says Namaste, the divine in me acknowledges the divine in you. Sri is honorific. Swami is renunciate. We have renunciates in our Christian tradition, right? We call them nuns and monks. They renounce the secular life or a life of spirit. And in the Hindu tradition, there's a word for a renunciate, a simple word, which is Swami. So you'll see Swami used for people who have renounced the secular life and who are probably also teachers.
Are there female Swamis?
Yes, it just means renunciate.
Okay.
So a woman could also be called a Swami, although we generally associate it with men, don't we?
Right, but they have the ability. I guess it's, I'm in the Christian faith, there's limitations, or there was. I don't know, I think it changed recently.
There's what?
Limitations, gender limitations. So I was wondering if it's the same with the Swami. Because we were making the connection between nun and priest and Swami, so I was wondering if there's the same.
I'm not entirely sure. And the tradition in India, of course, isn't static. What the tradition was 2,000 years ago when these scriptures were written is not the same as the tradition today, just as at the time of Jesus, traditions were different than what they are today. But I do believe Swami is used without gender attachment. And Satchidananda is often referred to as Sri Sachi, Sri Swami Satchidananda. He's also referred to as Guru. Guru has more of a connotation of teacher.
Okay.
Guru. All right, here's Satchidananda's commentary. He says, sacrifice, yajna, was given by the Creator. We don't usually think of it like that, do we?
No, we don't think of it as a gift. I don't.
It's
not part of our tradition to look at sacrifice as a gift. Now, he is going to show us why sacrifice was given by the Creator and is a beautiful gift. Because where he's going is, through sacrifice, we get everything we truly want. And only through sacrifice. Let's see how he develops that. Sacrifice was given by the Creator. His interpretation of the scripture is, don't look for anything just for yourself. Let your life be a sacrifice, a yajna. If you use this guidance which I give you, certainly you'll prosper. We talk a lot about prosperity and unity. A lot about a prosperity consciousness. Here's a different way of looking at it. If you use this guidance which I give you, certainly you'll prosper. Let your life be a sacrifice. Gotcha. Let's keep moving through this. In order to prosper, the most important thing, the one and only thing, is living a dedicated life. In order to prosper, the most important thing, the one and only thing, is living a dedicated life. Satchidananda is the great example, a great example, of living a dedicated life. He dedicated his life to be of service to others. Not for personal gratification, but to be an example for others so that they might experience the bliss that he felt. Satchidananda is not his born name, it's a name that he was given when he became a renunciate or a swami. Satchidananda.
Right. And if I may ask, dedication in life is something that that I feel is closely tied into what, and I'm sorry if it comes out slowly for me, I have certain issues processing it from, but dedication comes out to be something like that the dedication of living a life in service or some such would pronounce the spiritual inferences of other rules and laws abiding by the world, right? Or is this the other rules something different?
Let's continue to listen to Satchidananda's commentary and see if your question becomes more clear.
Okay.
And see if your and when your question becomes more clear, your answer will come along with it.
Okay.
So we're going to follow along with him. He's a lovely speaker. He loves stories, and he's going to give us some stories to help us press through and get more connected with this message. So he's suggesting we live a dedicated life. Now the question comes up, to what do we dedicate our lives? Let your entire life be a sacrifice, he says. This means renounce all your personal interest and personal desires. This sounds like a huge leap for Americans.
Yeah.
To renounce personal interest and personal desires. Yet he's saying, by renouncing personal interest and personal desires, somehow you get everything you really want. Live for the sake of others. Sacrifice is the law of life. This is his suggestion, that our dedication is to be in service for the sake of others, not only our children or our parents or our siblings, but everyone in the greater family of man and creation. Be of service. Sacrifice is a law of life. Let's hold this in consciousness and see how it unfolds through his teaching. This is said only to mankind because all other species are already doing it. Now he's having some fun.
Yeah.
Everything in this creation seems to exist to be used by others. Their life is a sacrifice. They live not for themselves, but for others. They are all still under that direct guidance of nature's law. All of life that we observe. No other species in this creation has the freedom humankind has. In nature's college, they are still under the control of the cosmic law. In simple devotees' language, every minute God simply tells them what to do, and they do it. Well, they never misbehave. Remember, we all lived that life before. Now he's going to talk about our evolutionary nature.
Oh, awesome.
During our evolution, we got all the lessons. When we were grass, we learned something.
Oh, that's going to be interesting.
How about when we were amoebas floating in the sea? When we became a little bush, we learned something else. When we became a worm, we learned something. We've all seen pictures of the fetus forming in a woman's womb, haven't we? How they start off looking like little fish, then they look like frogs, look like different animals we recognize. We learned when we were cats, dogs, scorpions, foxes, and cows. Somehow the evolution of life is in us today. Sometimes traces from the past are revealed. Now he's going to play with us a little bit. We hear people say, don't trust him, he's cunning like a fox. Why? Because that fox-like memory seems to be predominant, even in this life. We have evolutionary characteristics in us, instinctual. Look at that woman. For every little thing, she barks at others. That part was predominant. My goodness, he stings you for everything. My goodness, he stings you for everything. Or don't stand there like a tree, man. He's having some fun.
You bet.
He wants to break up our fixed notions of things. We lived all those lives. We all have those samskaras, mental impressions. So here's a new word for us, samskara. Samskara. Sort of sounded like scary to me when I first saw it. But it's a simple word, it just means mental impressions that we inherit. Rev. Russ today talked about reincarnation here at the sermon. He talked about how he experienced things as if they were from a previous life or an inheritance. Those mental impressions have a word in Sanskrit, they're samskaras. They're mental impressions buried as part of our subconscious treasure.
So is Satchitananda actually saying, though, that he believes in reincarnation here? Or is he just being more...
He does. Okay. He's not saying that, but he sees the truth in it.
Uh-huh.
And it is part of the Indian or Hindu consciousness.
Yeah.
So he observes through his studies and through his beliefs. As Rev. Russ talked about today in the sermon, that when you die, your body dies, not yet in a state of grace or spiritual transformation. There's some aspect of your soul or spirit, some energy in the universe, some energy that isn't complete yet. And somehow that energy attaches to a birth someplace. And another person is born with that unfulfilled energy. And in the cycle of birth and rebirth, until that person becomes spiritually transformed and is in God and sees God, loves God with all his heart, mind, soul, and spirit, then the cycle of birth and rebirth ends. Ends. And that energy or soul becomes at one with the universe. It doesn't need to re-express itself. That's sort of an idea behind the Hindu idea of reincarnation.
Yeah, I've had experiences like this, very traumatic, so, you know, it's more than a belief for me.
There you go, it's experience.
Yeah,
Rev. Russ had an experience, you've had an experience. When we have an experience, no one can disprove your experience, it's just something you experienced, so it's true, that's your truth. There's a name in Sanskrit for these mental impressions, as they're called. They're samskaras. And Satchidananda calls them a treasure. Our evolutionary nature of experiences a treasure. After having learned all that directly under the guidance of the Lord, now at the human level, the Lord says, okay, I taught you everything through evolution. I held your hand, walked you everywhere, and told you what to do. Now I want to test you.
It's a long test.
Now I want to
plenty
test
of chances
you.
To do it again and again.
Satchidananda doesn't have a heavy or somber notion of God or the divine or the universe. It's not something heavy, judgmental, somber. No, he has rather a playful experience of the divine. A playful, and he brings that playful experience of the divine into his teaching. So he sees God as saying, I held your hand, I walked you everywhere, now I want to test you. That means I give you the freedom. The freedom. Let me see how you can use your education. That's what is happening at the level of humanity.
Oh boy.
Can we use our education, our evolutionary nature, both of what we are,
yeah,
to pass to a spiritual transformation?
I wanted to ask, is the Bhagavad Gita referenced in any way where the practice of freedom is in this way, in this situation where you are tested, something that you have to apply your education through? Because when
ask your question again, please.
Sorry. When you get to the point where you deal with the test, and when you have walked with God and then, or the Lord, and you meet him and he says the freedom is yours, and then you have to use your education, does the Bhagavad Gita have any references there? That's why.
Many, many, many references.
Oh.
And by the way,
okay,
when Satchidananda is teaching here, he's not talking about some sort of absolute reality. These are all metaphorical statements, metaphors. Because how do we learn? We learn through stories and metaphors. The stories and metaphors are designed to touch us somewhere deeply and to find a truth that's already in us. Already in us. So this is not the truth. Rather, these are fingers pointing towards the truth.
Awesome.
And if those fingers touch us somehow and that we see the truth, then, as Kathy said, when we experience the truth, we don't need scriptures any longer. We've experienced it. So these are helpmates or pointers to a truth that is already inside of us, and that's what our quest needs to be, to experience the truth that's already inside of me and have these scriptures not give me something or teach me something so much as to take away some veil of ignorance that I have.
Yeah.
To dissolve some way of thinking I have that's gotten in the way of me experiencing my true nature.
Okay.
And those sorts of ways of thinking that we have, we grow up with, that get in the way, like a veil, from our experiencing our true nature, tends to reside in our ego minds. Our ego minds. Things we expect, things we want, our judgments, our judgments. This is good, this is bad.
The criticism, the critic inside.
Critic, yes. Can we have the critic? It is part of our nature. Can we have a critical nature, a judgmental nature, but not be attached to it?
Yeah, that's true.
We notice it, but not be driven by it. My mind finds this good. My mind finds this bad. I have a wonderful mind. Thank you for sharing. But the choice, and that's where freedom comes, to follow what the mind serves up, comes from a deeper place. And that's the freedom that we were given to choose.
And the freedom. The freedom. And what I learned from past teachers such as Edgar Cayce and many others that are metaphysical and traditions, I was raised in Catholicism, but I eventually learned from my research that things happen in life that make it so it's like a university.
Like
a university.
A university, yes. Our teacher.
Yes, and it's
life is our school.
Higher school, yeah. And that in turn means when we go out into reality and experience the world where I haven't been for so long. I've been at home for over like 10 years, and it's been tough, so I'm not experienced. But at least I say, though, that when we experience life and we start practicing the human side of freedom, I am not sure how it is that our education is linked to that, intrinsic energy.
How is our education linked to it?
Yeah.
When we go to school, we gain knowledge and learn more things. We learn more things when we go to school. That's knowledge. When we are devoted to our spiritual nature, our job is to unlearn things that don't serve us.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Unlearn things. So the path to knowledge is learning more and more things. The path to wisdom is unlearning things that don't serve us. They may still exist in our minds, but we unlearn them in a sense. We become less attached to our thoughts. The mind, like a muscle, has thoughts. It's something we have, like an arm or our hair. The mind is not who we are, it's just something we have. And the mind has thoughts. We're grateful for the thoughts. They mostly serve us.
You got it.
Do we have the discernment to notice when they don't serve us?
Right.
So we can step back from our own minds. Step back from our own minds and thus truly understand all things. We need to hear this in many different ways for it to sink in. Yes, Kathy.
I just want to add that the whole thing with reincarnation is that when it's something that perhaps was particularly heavy, difficult, traumatic, or whatever, which happened for me, it carries over those feelings, and it's sort of it can be a crazy-making experience because you don't understand why this is going on in this life. So part of my education was to, first of all, understand where it was coming from, why, and then to be able to let it go. I couldn't let it go until I understood what it was, what was happening and why. And then I could release it. And so it's...
Yes, so
that's sort of an extra fly in ointment, sort of.
I feel and felt the same way. I worked in my last home. I worked with a teacher, I would call her my guru, kind of, because she's a teacher, but she didn't like that title. Anyways, one of the first things we did was clear some of the past lives. Mm-hmm. But when I was very freshly started, I would always, why? Like, I had to know why, you know? And that was always kind of pushed to the side. Mm-hmm. Similarly, when I hear Steve speaking about these concepts, my mind immediately goes to Eastern, like education, Eastern and Western, and I'm in the field of education, and in Western education, there's an answer for everything. Mm-hmm. And it's usually the teacher's answer, and it's the right answer. Mm-hmm. And that's what it is, and you're tested on it. But then I found in Eastern, I've seen, you know, just right now, when a question was asked, and Steve wanted to point or lead to the answer, but not, like, I've just seen so many teachers, educators, not want to give an answer, because the answer is within ourselves. So my point is, I guess what I'm saying is, I've experienced that before, but then I've kind of trained myself to ask myself, like, why? You know, do I have pain in my shoulder because I was stabbed there? You know, oh my God, was I stabbed there? And if I'm, oh my God, I don't, does it matter? You know what I mean? Like, why am I putting value onto this issue that's not right here in front of me and part of my evolutionary future?
For me, it was more of it was not just a simple pain, it was more of a global, all it impacted the entirety of my life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it took a while, but it's okay.
We're at a time when we need to close because it's a few minutes before 11. I'd like to add a couple of observations to what I've heard you say. One, I heard you say that something came up in you from some past experience that you needed to understand to press through. Interesting that you use the word understand. That for me means you are standing under it so that you may look at it. And it is not who you are. It is something you're standing under and can see with perspective. That is what understand means for me. Understand. One of the things one hopes for in this Hindu tradition is that one will be reborn into a holy family, a family that practices yoga and practices spiritual traditions. One will be reborn. That is looked at as a blessing.
Yes, I see why.
As a blessing. I want to answer, make an observation of what I heard you say about questions and answers. I grew up as a mathematician. Math was easy for me. For some people it's difficult. It turned out for me, I gravitated towards it because it was easy. One of the things I liked about it was there were specific questions to which there were specific answers. That appealed to me. Specific questions, specific answers. You had theorems, axioms, and so on. However, I learned later on in life that there are other questions, and sometimes the answer is not so much how can I respond to that question, but have I asked a truthful question? Have I asked a truthful question? The typical example is, here's my question to you. When did you stop beating your wife? When did you stop beating your wife? Got it? That's not a truthful question. Questions always embed assumptions. And if those assumptions are not true, it's not a truthful question. So whenever a question plagues you, you don't know the answer. Rather than look for an answer, better look to see, is that a truthful question? Is that a truthful question? What is underlying that question that we all seem to agree on that may be shaky?
Can you give an example?
Yeah, so when you stop beating your wife, well, that assumes you beat your wife, but you don't beat your wife, do you?
Oh, the first thing that came to my head is a man who beats his wife, physically stops, but then mentally beats her. So then there's two, that's just the first thing that popped into my mind. There's a duality there. He believes he stopped beating his wife, but these bad habits are still there.
Yes, I hear you, but the question is not about wife beating, is it? It's rather about an assumption that underlies the question. It's a silly question. I meant it to be a silly question. But of course it's not, because who wants to be beaten by a husband?
Yeah,
the point is, what assumptions are there underlying that question? And if you go down, 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 until you find what the assumptions are and make sure that those assumptions are all in alignment with the truth of who you are, then the question can be held in consciousness. And if the question is true in that sense, generally the answer appears without effort. The question is true, generally the answer appears or will appear without effort. If you have to effort to find an answer to a question, generally there's something wrong with the question.
Gotcha.
Don't take my word for this.
Be passive.
Rather, look in your own experience the next time a perplexing question comes up for you, and look and see, well, what's underneath that? And see if it's true for you.
Sorry. I want to ask a quick one. Regards to asking questions about what is true, or truly asking a question rather than not asking one truly, what is the the original designer, what is the way that you could practice it better to do that easy?
Questions?
In a true question, yeah, true question. In a true question.
Yeah, how better to find a true question? How to become more skilled at asking a true question?
Hmm.
What can I do to ask better questions? What can I do when I'm asked an untruthful question?
Oh, the same.
To not try and give an answer which will not be with integrity. When you answer an untrue question, you can't possibly answer it with integrity.
Right. So it's like...
So how to train ourselves to be more alert for questions that are not grounded in truth, that are, in a sense, the wrong question. And the way to develop that skill, okay?
Oh.
You wanted an answer, here's an answer.
Oh boy, I got one. Okay.
The way to develop that skill is very simple. It's to be aware that not all questions are grounded in truth. Just to be aware.
Okay.
Just to be aware.
That,
to train yourself whenever there's a question which somehow throws you off kilter, to step back from that question and do not feel compelled to answer it. Rather, feel compelled to take that question into one's heart and look and see if there's another question that needs to be asked.
If someone's asking you the question, I think looking at intent and motive, that can help.
We will often see when a spiritual teacher is asked an untruthful or inappropriate question that has sort of a black and white answer, the teacher will not respond.
Yeah.
Sometimes a teacher will say, here's a better question, have you considered this?
Jesus was a master at that.
To develop that skill takes a lot of practice. We're not quite there yet. So if we hear a question directed towards us and we're somehow expected to answer, and our evolutionary nature wants to be loved and liked and respected, and we feel like we need to give an answer so that we'll be respected and loved and thought to be smart and so on, sometimes the smartest thing one can say is, let me think about that. Let me take that into consideration. I'm not sure at the moment. I respect you as a person for asking me the question. We don't want to disrespect others. I respect you as a person for asking me this question. Let me I'll respond then. And the next morning you may wake up and some truth may show up for you. Why? Because you became aware that questions need to be questioned.
Yeah.
That's the discernment.
That's a lot of things packed.
And when an answer to a question that makes you feel beautiful and joyful and at one and respectful of a person, when that answer pops up, maybe it was a truthful question and you can share a lovely, delightful, respectful, beautiful answer, and both sides feel good. When that happens, you can be pretty sure it was a truthful question and a lovely, truthful answer. Now you have to report back what your experience is and see if it's true for you. And you probably need to close because we've gone way over. Any other comments before we close today? Questions? And you can stay for a bit if you want, but we need to close our official session. We'd like to close our session by making the sound of Om together, taking ourselves down into that place of discernment inside of us. So we'll focus on three breaths. And with a deep in breath. Shanti, shanti, shanti. Peace.